Muslims worldwide getting into a festive mood as the Hajj pilgrimage culminates with Eid al-Adha. Anti-government protests rock Sri Lanka. The president flees just in time to avoid an angry mob overrunning his residence. Also coming up, Tunisia's president unveils an amended version of a highly criticized constitution ahead of a referendum later this month. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Muslims in many countries around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the end of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. The exact date of Eid al-Adha depends on lunar sightings and varies by country. Thousands of Palestinians performed the Eid prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Afghans also celebrated the occasion with prayers in mosques nationwide. Muslims in other regional countries, including Jordan, Egypt, Oman, Kazakhstan, and Turkey, have celebrated the event also. Slaughtering a sacrificed or sacrificial animal is part of the ceremonies to mark Eid al-Adha. That's done in remembrance of the Prophet Ibrahim's readiness to sacrifice his son in obedience to God. Iran and many countries elsewhere in the world, including in Asia and Africa, will mark Eid al-Adha on Sunday. Muslims performing Hajj rituals in the Saudi city of Mecca celebrate Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the culmination of the annual pilgrimage. Pilgrims are now performing the Stoning of the Devil, a ceremony symbolizing complete obedience to God. They do that at the tenth city of Mina, close to Mecca, after staying the night there. The pilgrims will then slaughter a sacrificial animal. After that, they will go to the Grand Mosque in Mecca to perform a final tawaf, or circling around the Kaaba. This year's Hajj pilgrimage is the biggest since the COVID pandemic began. Some 1 million Muslims, including 850,000 from outside of Saudi Arabia, are taking part. Hajj is one of the largest annual religious gatherings in the world. Crisis remains at boiling point in Sri Lanka. The Prime Minister is willing to resign to make way for an inclusive government. Ranil Wickremesinghe made the remarks after an emergency cabinet meeting was held. The Prime Minister said that he was willing to step down to make space for unity in a new government, stressing that he wanted to ensure public safety. The Prime Minister would have been next in line of succession if President Gotabaya Rajapaksa resigns. Earlier, thousands of protesters stormed the president's house and offices, sending him fleeing from his home. This after months of mounting public anger over the worst economic crisis that the country has witnessed in decades. Hundreds packed into rooms and corridors, shouting slogans against the president. Military personnel and police were unable to hold the crowds back, even after using water cannon and tear gas. Nearly 40 people have been injured as a result of clashes. People traveled to Colombo from all over Sri Lanka to join the protests. The capital city has been the site of demonstrations since April. Protesters are calling for the president's resignation, blaming his government for the economic hardships that they are facing. Sri Lanka has been crippled by a shortage of foreign exchange that has left it struggling to pay for fuel, food, and medicine. The island nation has sought an International Monetary Fund bailout to secure funds for essential commodities. Juhan Pereira is chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council. He attended the Colombo protests earlier today and then spoke to us about the ongoing rallies and people's demands for change in their country.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time. That, as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim. They are touring it. Hopefully they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful. Now, there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of the of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
The Tunisian president, Kais Saied, has demanded a draft constitution after the original version drew criticism over the powers that it gave to the head of state. The amended draft makes changes to two articles, including the one about rights and freedoms. Those articles have been criticized for paving the way for a dictatorial regime. President Saied published the amended version late on Friday, saying that he aimed to avoid confusion. Still, the new version is believed to retain a broad range of powers for the head of state. The new constitution will be put to a referendum this month and is the main part of Saied's plan to remake Tunisia's politics. Last year, he sacked the government and dissolved parliaments, a move seen by his critics as a coup against democracy. Moving on to the war in Ukraine, where Russian troops are seeking to push deeper into the eastern Donbas region, the current focal point of the battle. Ukrainian authorities say that several parts of Donetsk are now under Russian shelling. They say that five people have lost their lives over the past day. The city of Slovyansk is being shelled also. Meanwhile, Washington says it is sending $400 million in additional military supplies to Kiev. The U.S. and its allies have already sent millions of dollars in weapons packages to Ukraine. They have also imposed several rounds of sanctions on Moscow. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that continued bans could lead to catastrophic energy price rises in Europe. Russia's foreign minister has also accused the West of preventing Kiev from seeking a peace deal. Addressing a G20 meeting, Lavrov scolded Western powers for wasting an opportunity to tackle global economic issues. Moving on, Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, says the domestically built Damavand destroyer will soon join the Navy's northern fleet in the Caspian Sea. The Navy chief says that this will help maintain the country's territorial integrity and will deal a blow to enemies' illusions about Iran's defense capabilities. Damavand destroyer has been built using the most updated equipment. Irani was speaking on the sidelines of the second day of military drills in the Caspian Sea. Commenting on the drills, he said if similar exercises are held jointly with friendly neighboring countries, the security level of the strategic sea will increase significantly. Israel's Medical Association is assisting the regime in torturing Palestinians in the occupied territories. That is according to U.S.-based rights group Physicians for Human Rights. The group says it has listed the role of doctors who help in the torture of Palestinians by Israel's Shin Bet agency. There are more measures by the Israeli Medical Association also. The rights body says the association denies Palestinian medical staff the right to safety during the regime's raids. It also prevents Palestinian patients from receiving health care. Physicians for Human Rights says the Israeli Association is complicit in the regime's ethical failures and gross violations of human rights. The group says it has already filed a complaint to the International Medical Syndicate against the Israeli Association. Over the past years, Israel has pressed ahead with its demolition campaign of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories without being held accountable. The regime now plans to displace some 1,200 Palestinians living in a dozen villages south of the West Bank under the pretext of building a military zone there. That would lead to what is seen as the biggest mass eviction in decades on occupied land.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis.
The 12 villages that Israel plans to demolish are located in the Masafer Yatta area south of the West Bank city of El Khalil. The regime is forcing the Palestinian families living in that area to leave. That would displace at least 1,200 Palestinians, including over 500 children. The forced transfer has already been branded as a move in violation of international law.
The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it absolutely turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration, and they're sending a message by saying even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect, it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the U.N. Security Council that criticize the regime.
Britain's first-ever hijab-wearing MP may be voted out of becoming a Labour Party candidate in the future elections after she spoke out about alleged abuse that she has received since being elected as a Labour Party MP in 2019. Her treatment during her time in office has sparked accusations of Islamophobia and rule-breaking within the UK's biggest opposition party. Rob Carter examines the latest in the next report.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Afsana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Hereby congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. A happy Eid al-Adha to all our listeners.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis that has aggravated the country's economic conditions since President Kais Saied ousted the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority last year. Now, the crisis worsened when the president announced in March this year that he was dissolving the parliament. Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on the political crisis unfolding in Tunisia following drastic measures taken by the president to dissolve the elected parliament and dismiss scores of judges. We're asking, what direction will this North African country take after a referendum is held later this month? In the second part of our show today, we are discussing the continued impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders.
Tunisia in political turmoil. In July 2021, President Kais Saied dismissed the prime minister and suspended parliament. The Tunisian president said at the time that his decision was meant to save Tunisia, the state, and the Tunisian people. In the midst of growing public anger and protests against the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, President Said's decision was welcomed by many Tunisians tired of a frequently deadlocked post-revolutionary democracy. However, in a pointer to a polarized country, thousands of Tunisians opposed to the move have continued to hold demonstrations across the country.
As part of his reform agenda, President Said has organized a referendum on a new constitution that his opponents claim will cement his hold on power. Sadouk Belaid, coordinator of the National Consultative Commission for a New Republic, charged with drafting the new document, speaks here after presenting the draft constitution to President Said.
The conditions for drafting the constitution were difficult because of the short time we had at our disposal. But we managed, thanks to everyone's efforts, to submit this first version of the constitution. We hope that this will satisfy the president.
Now, to discuss the unfolding situation in Tunisia, we contacted Hamdi, the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, Tunisians are protesting against a constitutional referendum called by President Said. This draft constitution has been produced through a national dialogue that excluded the main opposition forces and was boycotted by the powerful UGTT Trade Union Confederation. Now, can it bring the desired results of political stability and progress in Tunisia?
I think it's important to remember or stress that the constitution that was overthrown by Kais Saied, the 2014 constitution, was negotiated by an elected parliament for over 3 years, clause by clause. It was carefully negotiated, carefully drafted, carefully discussed, carefully debated, and then it was presented in 2014. Kais Saied's constitution, however, has been drawn up in less than 30 days by a select group of individuals specifically appointed by Kais Saied without the input of the experts who refused to participate in his commission to draft the constitution, and without the input of the opposition political parties, or indeed any political party that has been elected by the Tunisian people. In other words, it's a unilaterally written constitution in accordance with the desires of Kais Saied, and therefore this is an imposition of a constitution as opposed to a democratic constitution, and therefore it's very unlikely that it's going to lead to this political stability that Kais Saied promises, especially given that even the trade unions who support the coup have announced that they are not going to support his constitution or support his roadmap.
The first article of Tunisia's 2014 constitution and its 1959 predecessor defined the country as a free, independent, and sovereign state. Islam is its religion and Arabic is its language. However, Tunisian President Kais Saied now says that the draft constitution to be put to a referendum on July 25 will not enshrine Islam as the religion of the state. What led to this decision and what is the significance of this announcement, especially considering that Ennahda, an Islamic party, is one of the most popular parties in the country?
I think it's important to remember one thing. The first is that Tunisia has often wrestled with the Islamic identity and has often wrestled with the Islamic identity in a bid to try to win international support. Kais Saied is removing Islam from the constitution in contradiction to what he said in 2014 when he said that this is a clause that should be supported. Kais Saied has removed this clause in the constitution in a bid to present his own coup as progressive to an international community that is not comfortable with his coup.
President Said also dismissed 57 judges on June 1st, accusing them of corruption and protecting terrorists. The Tunisian Judges Association has rejected the charges, saying they are mostly politically motivated. Analysts believe the judges have been removed for failing to toe the president's line.
I think it's important to remember that since Kais Saied seized power for himself on the 25th of July 2021, almost a year ago, he's been dragging his political opponents before the courts and before military courts in a bid to try to convict them on charges of corruption. The idea here is that if Saeed can convict his political opponents of corruption, then he can by extension convict the democratic process that he's overthrown of corruption. He can argue and say that I've overthrown a corrupt democratic process, and the proof is that these political opponents who have been elected are guilty of corruption.
Recently, Tunisia's main trade union confederation, UGTT, called up to 3 million public sector workers to strike, halting work at 159 state agencies and public companies to demand concessions on salaries and reforms. Now, UGTT chief Noureddine Tebboubi has also blamed the government for not including this powerful union in national dialogue. Now, what is the impact of the strike, and will the government respond positively to the workers' demands?
I think it's important to stress that the trade union strike against Kais Saied is not because of the conditions of the workers. It's not about workers' pay, even though that's what the trade unions claim it is about. Instead, it's about this power struggle that's unfolding between the trade unions and Kais Saied. The trade unions wholeheartedly backed Kais Saied's coup, but they believe that Kais Saied would be subservient to them, that they would be able to control Kais Saied, they would be able to influence Kais Saied, and they would be able to impose their own desire on the process of the coup in a manner similar to what they did with the National Dialogue in 2013, 2014. The problem, however, for the trade unions is that Kais Saied has monopolized power. He refuses to share power. He refuses to engage with the trade unions. The problem the trade unions have is that they don't want this coup to fall because they don't want the Islamists to come back to power. The leftist trade unions have a rabid hatred for the Islamists and are very frustrated that the Islamists keep winning in the democratic elections. So they want this coup to stay. The problem, however, is that Saeed is not engaging them, and they are worried about going hard against Saeed because they don't want this coup to topple.
The head UGTT trade union has rejected International Monetary Fund conditions for a new loan to bail out Tunisia's struggling economy and has questioned the government's authority to negotiate. President Saeed has made concessions demanded by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, cutting subsidies and wages.
An economist says if the government fails to convince the population, then it will not be able to implement economic reforms.
The negotiations with the IMF will take place amid an unprecedented economic crisis in Tunisia. Therefore, the authorities will make many sacrifices. The government needs to convince the population that the reforms are necessary. Otherwise, it will not be able to implement any change or reform.
Now, why is the president obeying these IMF conditions at the expense of the welfare of the people?
I think when it comes to the negotiations regarding the IMF, it's important to remember that Tunisia is in a very dire economic situation that is spiraling out of control and spiraling into ever-increasing crises and woes for the ordinary Tunisian. The reason that the Tunisians protested against the democratic transition or protested against parliament, the reason why many Tunisians are not interested in seeing parliament return, which is something that has helped Kais Saied, is because they believe that the parliament has not delivered on the aspirations of the Arab Spring, which were rooted in economic development. They wanted better jobs. They wanted they wanted the alleviation of poverty. They wanted equal opportunities. They wanted a better standard of living. None of that has been delivered. And Kais Saied is aware that as in 2016, 2017, Youssef El-Shehid, the prime minister then, also had very high poll ratings when he first came to power and he was seen as combating corruption. But Youssef El-Shehid's failure to tackle the economy meant that people very quickly turned against him.
Amid the political crisis in Tunisia, the government recently announced that it had launched an investigation of an attempt to assassinate President Kais Saied. Justice Minister Hasna Ben Saliman told a local radio that she approved the Court of Appeals prosecutor investigating the attempt, but gave no further details.
Now, our last question. Where is Tunisia heading in the next months and years amid the political turmoil and economic crisis?
I think the reality is that the international community appears to be approaching Kais Saied's coup as with the approach that is similar to that with which they approached the coup in Egypt when Sisi overthrew the democratically elected president. They are aware they are unable to get enough people to the streets to demand the return of parliament. And they've also changed tactic into recognizing the suspension of parliament, but asking for an inclusive national dialogue, essentially offering a concession to recognize Saeed's emergency measures in exchange for being included in the political process. And I think this is the tragedy of what is unfolding in Tunisia, in that at this moment in time, because of the dire economic situation, there's a lack of appreciation as to the importance of the democratic transition, and more a focus on who can deal with the economic crisis, who can deal, whether it's democracy or dictatorship, just as long as they can deal with the economic crisis. And I think this apathy towards the democratic process is what benefits Kais Saied.
Well, there you have it. The dire economic situation in Tunisia has created apathy towards the democratic process in the country. We'd like to thank our guest Sami Hamdi for his incisive analysis, and we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the continuing impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders. Stay with us.
African leaders snub Ukrainian president.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
On the 20th of June, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the African Union during a virtual meeting in which only four heads of state from the continent took part.
According to reports, all the heads of state of the continent were invited. But apart from the African Union chairman, President Macky Sall of Senegal, only three of them participated from their respective presidential offices: Alassane Ouattara of Ivory Coast, Mohamed El Menfi, President of the Libyan Council, and Denis Sassou Nguesso of Congo. In his belated address, the Ukrainian president tried to convince the few African leaders listening to him that the conflict in his country was the reason for the sharp increase in food prices.
This war may seem very distant to you and your countries, but catastrophically rising food prices have already brought it home to millions of African families.
Many in Africa hold the view that the conflict in Ukraine was imposed by Western powers. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has openly blamed the US-led NATO military alliance for the war in Ukraine and said he will resist calls to condemn Russia.
For us, this is an important development. Whilst other people scream and shout, we want to focus on the outcome, the positive outcome of those negotiations and that mediation process. That is what is important.
For more on the conflict in Ukraine and its impact on Africa, we contacted Tshetso Magema, a former member of South African Parliament. Now, only four presidents were interested in holding a video conference with the Ukrainian president, while he had requested to address all African leaders after months of intense lobbying. Now, why did African leaders decide to snub Zelensky?
There is a general feeling both amongst the population of the African continent and the leadership that this is a war that should not have happened. It is a war that could have been prevented, but for the hubris and arrogance of Western leaders, in particular the EU and the US. And so it led us and left us in this situation. And so there is that sense that, look, we don't want to be drawn into what is essentially a US/EU/NATO war against Russia. And so there is that understanding that Russia had to act in one way or the other.
When the Ukrainian president was given a chance to address African Union leaders, he claimed that Africa is in reality a hostage of Russia's war. Let's listen in.
Africa is actually taken hostage, hostage of those who started the war against our state.
Remarks by the Ukrainian president have been termed by many as arrogant and typical of Europe's condescending attitudes towards Africa. Now, Mr. Magema, what's your take on these remarks by the Ukrainian president?
Look, generally as Africans, we take umbrage, at such arrogance especially Westerners to want to tell us what our state is, what our conditions are. We are very clear, we are nobody's hostage. And indeed, the AU has taken such a position in general in terms of its attitude that we are nobody's hostage. We are indeed, there are some challenges that arise out of this thing, but we reject the notion, that we are hostage as if, as Africans, we do not have agency to act. And so it's actually, we see it as an affront to African agency to really, engage with the world and do business and pursue our own interests, as Africans. But then again, it is that kind of racist arrogance that we have, become accustomed to, and notwithstanding the fact that we've been rejecting it for all the centuries of colonialism since we got into contact with Western civilization. So in that sense, that statement means nothing to us. We don't see ourselves as hostages.
Well, the European Union has aggressively pursued sanctions and a severing of economic ties in a bid to punish Russia for its military operations in Ukraine, a strategy that has attracted widespread criticism.
South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said that bystander countries were suffering due to sanctions against Russia.
Now, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia are going to have and are having an overarching impact. Even those countries that are either bystanders or not part of the conflict are also going to suffer from the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia.
After imposing sanctions, Western countries are accusing Russia of being behind a worsening food shortage in Africa. Is it agreeable to claim that Russia is the main reason behind the so-called food crisis in Africa?
It seems to me that, a food crisis in Africa, put in those terms, is really being used as a, as a beating stick, a stick to beat Russia with, to say, but Russia, you are responsible for a food crisis in Africa, because Africa, of course, is one of those vulnerable parts of the world where we have famines and food crises breaking out every, now and then, every decade or two or so. And so in that sense, Africa, the crisis is not as deep, at least as some would suggest.
Since the beginning of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, people in Africa condemn the double standards of treatment of African nationals. Many Africans were physically attacked by Ukrainian police and endured maltreatment from the country's authorities, including being left stranded and helpless in freezing temperatures. An African student speaks after escaping a harrowing experience in Ukraine.
I remember they punched a certain black guy, a policeman in Ukraine, punched a certain black guy for nothing. He was shocked for nothing. Yes, so like I said earlier on, they consider white people before considering black people.
Volodymyr Zelensky said in February that any African students who leave Ukraine will not be welcome there once the war is over. Africans will certainly never forget how they experienced racism while trying to escape the conflict in Ukraine.
Now, regardless of whether the conflict in Ukraine is the source of the food crisis in Africa or not, many agree that the continent needs to end dependence on food imports. The president of the Africa Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, says the bank is funding agricultural projects in the continent to end dependency on imports.
We have a $1.5 billion facility. It's not just the money. We have the systems in place across Africa. And that facility will allow African countries to produce 38 million metric tons of food. I told you we'll lose 30 million metric tons of food from Russia. So it produced 38 million metric tons of food. But that food will be broken down into what we're actually dealing with. There will be 11 million metric tons that will be wheat. There will be 18 million metric tons that will be maize. There will be 6 million metric tons that will be rice. 2.5 million metric tons that will be soybeans.
Now, what can African countries learn from the conflict in Ukraine, especially in terms of reviving agriculture and rebuilding regional sovereign grain reserves to avoid the current situation?
There's about 70% of the world's available arable land cannot ensure its food security. And so it's crucial that, African leaders in earnest begin to work on practical projects, bankable projects that will ensure, grain and wheat and fertilizer production on the continent. But that also, I must add, will require that we push the IMF and World Bank, who have, in fact, in many ways deindustrialized our agricultural sector and made it less profitable for African countries to grow their own food, vis-a-vis the importation of cheap products from abroad. And so that is the strategic task that face our continent and its leaders. And there needs to be really a lot of work. I mean, South Africa is doing well in that regard. It's a net exporter. That work must still continue and be expanded.
Well, indeed, Africa needs to ensure self-reliance in food security, and this requires dedicated leadership. We'd like to thank our guest, Isetho Magama, a former member of South African Parliament, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
هيهات أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيت أو تبعد من أدنيت أو تشرد من آويت أو تسلم إلى البلاء من كفيته
Brothers and sisters, this part of the Divine Command supplication was under discussion. Hayhat, anta akramu min an tudayya man rabbayta. Far be it from you. You will not torture him whom you have nurtured. You are more generous than that. أو تبعد من أدنيته. Or to banish him whom you have brought up. أو تشرد من أويته. Or to drive away him whom you have given an abode. أو تسلم إلى البلاء من كفيته ورحمته. Or submit to tribulation him whom you have spared and shown mercy. Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying, O Allah, you are so merciful and so generous that you have addressed the sinful man. You called me and I answered you. You asked me and I granted you. You left me, but I watched you. You disobeyed my orders, but I concealed your sins. Allah says, if you returned to me, I would accept you. And if you went away from me, I wait for your return to me. I am the most generous of the generous. I am the most forgiver of the forgivers and the most merciful of the merciful. In this part, I'd like to read to you, dear listeners, a narration from Allama Majlisi from Ali bin Ibrahim Qummi. It is said, when Qarun denied the prophethood of Prophet Musa, refusing to pay zakat of his wealth and starting to accuse Musa, the latter complained to Allah about him. The Almighty told Prophet Musa, I ordered the heavens and the earth to obey you. Give them whatever order you want. So Prophet Musa went to Qarun's house while he had his servants close all the doors to Prophet Musa. When Prophet reached that palace, when he saw all the doors closed, Musa pointed to the doors, all of them were opened. When Qarun saw Prophet Musa, he knew that Musa has come with a lost chastisement. And he said, O Moses, I ask you for our tie of kinship to have mercy on me. You already know that it is narrated that Qarun was the cousin of Prophet Musa. Then Moses addressed the earth, take Qarun. Therefore, the place and everything in it was descended into the earth. Even at that time, Qarun wept and requested Prophet Musa on account of their kinship. But Prophet Musa replied again, do not talk to me, even though Qarun deplored. But Musa did not accept because he was angry of his indecent deeds. Because probably Qarun had accused Prophet Musa of shameful acts. And then after Qarun's death, Prophet Musa went to his worship place where he was addressed by Allah. Oh Musa, Qarun and his people requested you, but you did not heed them. By my glory, if he had deplored to me, I would have accepted him. But since he called you, I left him to you. Look at the vastness of the mercy of the Almighty Allah, that he is even about to shower his mercy upon Qarun and his people, who had accused the Prophet of their time.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity, and despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity. No, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah, God, that we're here, feeling so good. I'm
It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable. Knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of Dua.
In this part, let us now have a look at another narration. It is written in Tafsir Naishaburi that in Prophet Muhammad's time, a young man was close to his death. The Prophet ﷺ was asked to visit the sick young man, and the Prophet of Islam came to the young man while he was unable to utter his testimonies. He could not say that Allah is one. He could not say that I believe in the prophethood of Muhammad. The Prophet ﷺ asked his acquaintances, has he been forgetful about prayer? He was answered in negative. He asked again, has he refused to pay zakat? The people around the sick youngster denied it too. The Prophet questioned them, has his father cursed him? They answered negatively. The Prophet asked again, has his mother cursed him? And then the people said yes. So the Prophet said, call his mother and ask her to forgive his son. The mother refused to do so, saying, how can I forgive him while he has beaten me in the face and hurt one of my eyes? The Messenger of Allah ordered to bring fire. The sick man's mother asked the reason for bringing fire. The Prophet ﷺ replied, I want to burn him for the sin he has committed. The mother said, I don't want him to be burned. Because I bore him for 9 months in my womb, I breastfed him for 2 years, I trained, I lived with him for many years. I forgive him to be saved from being burnt. While a mother who is just one's conventional trainer does not wish her disobedient child to be burnt, how would Allah, who is the human's true trainer, who has developed him from poorness to excellence, torture his disobedient servant? Far be it from you. Hayhat, anta akramu min an tudayya man rabbayta. You are more generous than torturing him whom you have nurtured. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.